Most of the time, a baby is delivered head first. When it's in this position during pregnancy, it's called a cephalic presentation. Breech presentation is when the baby's bum is set to be delivered first. 3-4% of all babies are in this less favorable position by the end of pregnancy. And while we've always known that bum first or breech babies were more complicated to deliver vaginally, the best way to deliver them was not always known. That was until the year 2000 when the term breech trial was published in The Lancet. Let's take a look. Hello and welcome to the Evidence-Based Medicine Podcast, where every week we delve into a landmark clinical trial that has shaped medicine. I'm Daniel Aronov, and today, the term breech trial. This study was a randomized controlled trial comparing cesarean section to vaginal delivery for pregnancies that were in breech presentation at term. So there are a few issues with vaginal breech deliveries compared to the head first or cephalic deliveries. Firstly, when going head first, the skull has several hours to mold to the shape of the pelvis, to become longer so that it can pass through more easily. With breech delivery, there's no such molding, and so the skull, which has to pass quickly through the pelvis, is at higher risk of injury. Secondly, sometimes the bum just isn't big enough to dilate the cervix fully, especially with preterm babies. And so the body passes through a non-fully dilated cervix, but when it's time for the head to pass, it can get stuck, and this is called head entrapment. Other issues with breech are that the umbilical cord can be compressed as it's jammed between the baby's head and the pelvis, and this can impact the baby's oxygen supply. And there are many other issues with breech vaginal deliveries. So even at the time of the study in the year 2000, the best way to deliver a breech baby was pretty controversial. Across the developed world, breech babies were delivered vaginally maybe half the time, and there was really no good quality evidence to guide doctors on which way was the best. There had only been 2 randomized controlled trials on the issue prior to this study, and they only had 100 and 200 patients in them. These 2 studies didn't find a difference between vaginal or cesarean delivery for breech babies, but such low numbers are probably not powered to pick up small differences in outcomes. So, this could be the most impactful trial ever done in obstetrics. The study has been cited 1,626 times, which means that 1,626 other studies have referenced it. Now, in the scientific world, this is the social media equivalent of someone sharing your post, so it's kind of a big deal. So what did the trial do? Well, they randomized 2,088 pregnant women who were presenting in a breech presentation at 37 weeks or more to one of 2 groups. The first group got planned vaginal delivery, and the second group got planned cesarean section. And this is a huge study. They were recruiting women from 26 different countries using 121 clinical centers. Now, the women could either have frank breech or complete breech. Frank breech is where the baby is bent at the hips and the knees are straight, so the baby's kind of folded in half. Whereas complete breech is where the hips are bent but the knees are also bent. So they were both included in the trial, but they were excluded if they were in a footling presentation, which is where the baby's feet are below the bum and are likely to come out first. This is because even before this study, footling presenting babies were almost always delivered by C-section. Women were also excluded if they were having very big babies, and they defined really big babies as an estimated weight of 4 kilograms or more, which is 8.8 pounds for all those playing at home in America, playing at home in America. Okay, so allocation was concealed, and the plan would be that if they were randomized to the C-section group, they would schedule it in at any time from 38 weeks onwards. But on the day of the C-section, they would make sure the baby was still in breech, and if it had managed to move into the cephalic presentation, they would then just plan a normal vaginal delivery. Now, about 40% of the mums were randomized at the time of labor, and so they would have been pretty quickly rushed off to get their cesarean section after being randomized to that group. If they were randomized to the planned vaginal delivery group, they would just wait for them to labor spontaneously, unless for whatever reason they needed induction of labor, and then they had a whole protocol on how induction of labor was to be managed, which, as you can imagine, would have been pretty difficult to arrange across 121 birthing centers, each with their own protocol. The primary outcome was the death of the baby either during labor or in the first 28 days of life, or like really bad things happening to the baby. And there were a heap of these. Birth trauma, which included subdural hematoma, intracerebral hemorrhage, spinal cord injury, basal skull fractures, and peripheral nerve injury, or clinically significant genital injury, seizures occurring at less than 24 hours of age or requiring two or more drugs to control them, Apgar score of less than 4 at 5 minutes, cord blood-based deficit of at least 15, hypotonia for at least 2 hours, stupor, decreased response to pain or coma, intubation and ventilation for at least 24 hours, tube feeding for 4 days or more, or admission to the neonatal intensive care unit for longer than 4 days. So that ridiculously long list of bad things that can happen to a newborn baby is called a composite primary outcome. The reason they clumped a billion and one things together is because the primary outcome, or primary endpoint, which is another way of calling it, is what the entire trial is designed around. The decision on how many people to recruit, for example, is all designed around this primary outcome. And even the statistical hocus pocus that goes into determining if something is statistically significant is also designed around this primary outcome. Because of this, there can only be one primary outcome. So what studies often do is make one giant composite primary outcome, and that gives it more chance of becoming statistically significant. And most of the time, it's fair enough. The most common use of composite outcomes is in cardiovascular trials, where they group together what they call MACE, major adverse cardiac events, like heart attack and stroke. But sometimes, the composite outcome are a bit ridiculous. I mean, even in this trial, can you really say that having an Apgar score of less than 4 at 5 minutes is really the same as neonatal death or spinal cord injury? So now if there is a reduction in the primary outcome with one of the groups, is it because more babies died or because more had a low Apgar score at 5 minutes but turned out to be perfectly healthy babies at discharge? And even with cardiovascular trials, they often add in revascularization to the primary outcome along with heart attack, stroke, and death. But I mean, is getting a stent the same thing as having a heart attack? I mean, can you even walk past a cardiologist in the corridor without getting a stent? So anyway, let's just keep that in mind when we go through the results. They had a bunch of secondary outcomes as well, and these were all mainly centered around harm to the mother. Things like maternal death, postpartum hemorrhage, deep vein thrombosis, and many more. So now let's look at what actually happened to the women assigned to the two groups. So of those assigned to cesarean section, 90% actually delivered by cesarean section. The 10% who were delivered vaginally did so either because they managed to turn cephalic, or they had progressed too quickly in labor that it was too late for C-section, or because the mother had changed her mind last minute and they decided against C-section. Of those assigned to the planned vaginal birth, only 56% ended up delivering vaginally. The rest were delivered via C-section, and the most common reason being that they just weren't progressing in labor, or the baby was too big for the pelvis. So what were the results? Now, I just want to warn anyone listening that the information I'm about to present might be a bit sensitive, so if you're not in the mood for hearing about bad things happening to babies, you might want to sit this one out. Okay, so the composite primary outcome with all the bad stuff that can happen to a newborn baby, coupled with some less bad stuff, I guess, that went from 5% in the planned vaginal delivery group to 1.6% in the cesarean section group. So there was a 3.4% decrease in what they called serious neonatal morbidity or neonatal mortality with planned C-section over planned vaginal delivery. The number needed to treat was 30, which means that for every 30 breech babies we deliver via planned C-section instead of planned vaginal delivery, we will prevent one bad thing happening to the baby. So let's look at the breakdown of the components of this primary outcome. Starting with perinatal or neonatal death, this went from 1.3% with planned vaginal delivery to 0.3% with planned C-section. So a 1% decrease in baby death with planned C-section. Okay, so I'm going to be reading out a lot of numbers over the next 2 minutes, so feel free to tune out or tune into the outcomes that interest you. I'll meet you back on the other side. All right, so birth trauma went from 1.4% to 0.6% with planned cesarean section. And this was mainly because of decreased bone fractures and brachial plexus injuries. Hypotonia, which lasted greater than 2 hours, went from 1.8% to 0.2%. There was a decrease in low APGAR score at 5 minutes. It went from 0.9% to 0.1% with planned C-section. And rates of intubation and ventilation also decreased from 1.3% to 0.3%, and neonatal ICU admission decreased from 3% to 1.5%. So they were the main neonatal outcomes, and they pretty much all looked better for the planned cesarean section group. In terms of maternal outcomes, there was really no difference here. No difference in postpartum bleeding, mortality, genital tract injury, wound issues, or infection. Having said that, they didn't look at pain and return to normal function, which I think we know would have been better in the planned vaginal delivery group. Interestingly, they reanalyzed the data to see if there was a difference in baby outcomes depending on how well trained the obstetrician was in doing vaginal breech deliveries. And it did seem to make a difference. Instead of that 5% risk of the primary outcome with planned vaginal delivery, if they only looked at obstetricians who were super trained, with more than 20 years of experience in delivering breech babies, this primary outcome went down to 3.2%, which is still greater than C-sections, which, if you remember, was 1.6%, but still better than the vaginal breech delivery average. So what's the bottom line? Well, for women presenting at full term with pregnancies in breech, but who have favorable conditions for a vaginal breech delivery, planned cesarean section will reduce the chance of the baby dying or experiencing poor outcomes in the immediate neonatal period compared with planned vaginal delivery. The reduction is by 3.4%, and this includes a decrease in baby death by 1%. So, what do you think of these numbers? Well, while we're on the theme of equating scientific literature to social media, I should let you know that this study went viral. I mean, it went absolutely viral, like Gangnam-style viral. For breech deliveries in the Netherlands, for example, the cesarean section rate went from 50% to 80% within 2 months of this study being published. The American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology changed their guidelines within a few months from publications of this study. It now recommends planned cesarean section for all term singleton breech presentations. In Australia, by 2005, only 3.7% of babies in breech presentation were delivered vaginally. And the number of obstetricians confident in performing a breech delivery vaginally diminished across the world. In 2006, a survey was done on Australian obstetrics and gynecology trainees who were in their final year of training, and only 11% of them said they would offer a vagina delivery to their women in breech. So, when counseling women about the risks of vaginal breech deliveries, do we still use this 3.5% figure to quantify the increase in harms? Or do you think it would be even worse now that we've seen this widespread de-skilling in vaginal breech delivery? Now, the term breech trial researchers published another paper 2 years later where they followed up a selection of the original babies in the term breech trial to see if there was any difference in outcomes after a couple of years. So out of the 121 clinical centers involved in the original trial, 85 of them were pre-selected to be involved in this two-year follow-up. So out of the 2,088 women in the actual term breech trial, 1,159 were to be included in this two-year follow-up study. So as the child reached 2 years of age, the investigators sent out questionnaires to these 1,159 women about their child's development. Questions about communication, gross motor skills, fine motor skills, problem-solving skills, and personal social skills. The plan was to see whether there was any difference in child death rates outside of the initial neonatal period that they looked for in the original study, or if there was any neurodevelopmental delay. Now, as you can imagine, some women didn't complete this two-year survey or changed address or whatever. So out of the 1,159 women that they were planning on following up at 2 years, they only managed to get data from 920. So out of the 920 women, there was no difference in death or neurodevelopmental delay between the planned cesarean section and the planned vaginal delivery from breech babies at 2 years follow-up. Okay, so Just a final little discussion. There has been quite a stir in the obstetric world about this trial that even carries out today. In 2004, there was a commentary from an obstetrician largely bashing this trial. Haters gonna hate, 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 hate. But seriously, trial commentaries that are published in journals are basically the equivalent of trolling in the social media world. I mean, it's dressed in a guise of professionalism and scientific process, but it's pretty much the same thing. So this one was published in the BMJ, and the main points of this commentary and of all the criticisms of this trial are, you know, you shouldn't have used short-term outcomes as your endpoints. The long-term data should have been the primary outcome. That the breech vaginal deliveries are a skill and that you can't put a skill to a randomized controlled trial, that they shouldn't have used so many clinical centers for such a complicated trial, and there were others as well. And the reason I single out this commentary was because the lead author of the term breech trial, Mary Hanna, actually wrote a response to this particular commentary, which I thought was rather good. And I just wanted to end with a quote from her response, which is a great summary of the findings of the term breech trial. Here goes. For those women preferring a vaginal breech birth, they should be reassured that although planned cesarean section reduced the risk of perinatal or neonatal mortality or serious neonatal morbidity compared to planned vaginal birth, in the term breech trial, 95% of babies in the planned vaginal birth arm did well. Also, although our statistical power was limited, we did not find planned cesarean to be associated with better outcomes for the children at 2 years of age. Okay, thanks for listening. Please let me know what you think of this trial. Did the results warrant the drastic reduction in vaginal breech deliveries that we saw? I would love to hear your thoughts. There are multiple avenues of communication. You can leave a comment on the website, www.ebmpodcast.com, or Twitter me at Dr. Aronov. That's at DRARONOV. Please check out my patient education videos on YouTube at www.youtube.com/DrDanMD, DRDANMD. Okay, next week, speeding up the passage of kidney stones. Relaxing the smooth muscle of the ureter should theoretically make it easier for kidney stones to pass through. So, do calcium channel blockers and alpha blockers, which relax the muscles of the ureter, lead to faster stone passage? That's next week. I'm Daniel Aronov. I'll speak to you then.